This is Ursula Wiritz, September 9th, 1991. Eros Betrayed.
Just to remember and to be careful not to confuse our professional responsibility with this issue of seduction. Whoever seduces, it is always the professional responsibility of those who are supposed to care not to act upon the seduction. Whatever their personal sexual countertransference feelings might be. Of course, we may ask ourselves, why is it that female therapists do not abuse sexually as often as male do? And I think it might be interesting, perhaps later, after I give my talk in the discussion, to comment on this. After all, I think we do live in a society where women are not as easily encouraged to express their sexual wishes and their sexual needs, whereas we are quite used within our culture and within our female socialization to be confronted with men who, rather bluntly, I would say, express their sexual needs and urges. Of course, when we think about the differences between male or female analytical style, we might raise the question, are there differences? And how? In Germany, sometimes we say, as a definition of psychology, psychology is a professionalization of a female service. And what is meant is that what is considered to be therapeutic, to be effective in the process of a therapeutic cure, are qualities that have to do with being nurturing, caring, listening, putting one's own needs second, standing back. Now, all of these qualities belong in our culture within the female socialization process. Therefore, one could ask if what is expected from therapists as a professional attitude, if this is not what women as mothers, as lovers do all the time. Now, speaking as a Jungian, I said that for me, the issue of sexual abuse is connected with Eros and with the betrayal of Eros. Maybe it is helpful to remind you what the notion of Eros means. Eros is considered to be a mediator between the humans and the gods. Eros is a creative force, a tremendous, powerful force that tends to bind together what is separate. I don't know if you are familiar with Plato Symposion. Those of you who are might remember how Plato describes what Eros is. He says, Eros is a tremendous demon, a godly force. And when Jung talked about Eros, he said, where love reigns, there is no will to power, and where power predominates, love is missing. Now, the psychological contrary of Eros would be the will to power. Power, I think, is one of the key issues when we deal with the abuse that happens in therapeutic relationships. If you think of Freud's, the foundation of psychoanalysis, and the recommendations that he has put forth for the analytical process, he talked about the rule of abstinence. He said, the cure, which meant the analysis, has to be conducted in abstinence. By abstinence was meant various factors, but the one thing was not to manipulate and not to allow to be or to become manipulated. Abstinence at its very origin had a lot to do with being neutral, the myth of objectivity. After all, Freud was a scientist, and coming from this tradition of positivism, where the researcher had to be objective and nothing subjective was allowed to come into the picture. So the original idea was that the analyst had to take a neutral stance. He was not allowed to be an educator. He was not allowed to be a preacher. He was not supposed to manipulate or to use suggestion, because the cure was meant to be a cure that happened via self-exploration and not via the powerful attitude of the physician over the patient, of the analyst over the client. So this whole question of influence was at the very core of psychoanalysis. Now, by now we know that this myth of objectivity, this myth of being neutral, this does not exist. Originally, for example, at the first psychoanalytic institute in Germany in the 30s, which was considered to be an extremely rigid institute, it was being discussed if an analyst was allowed to wear his wedding ring while he was practicing. Because after all, this would reveal something about his personality. And the idea, the original idea, was nothing about the personality of the analyst should be revealed. He should, in fact, be, as Freud said, like a mirror that does not reflect anything else but what is shown to him. It was being discussed, for example, if analysts were allowed to decorate their walls in the office with paintings. Would it not lead to making conclusions or interpretations about the personality of the analyst if I, for example, had Picasso prints on the walls. So from this original, rather rigid recommendations that Freud gave, like, for example, one should take, as a psychoanalyst, the example of the surgeon who puts all his human effects aside to, in order to skillfully operate. Now, if you imagine walking into the office of an analyst today who would put all his or her human feelings aside in order to cure you skillfully, I think you would probably walk out as fast out of the office as you walked in. But I think it is important, in order to understand the whole development from a rather rigid recommendation of an abstinence position towards the client, not to gratify the client's needs, not to answer any personal questions, never to accept an invitation outside the analytical relationship, never to accept gifts from the present. The only thing that was allowed was verbal communication and the interpretation of the unconscious and conscious acts. Now, since psychology has moved on, and particularly within the context of humanistic psychology, the understanding of what analysis is all about, what really is at the very center of this analytical encounter, has changed tremendously. Where, when we started out with abstinence within the humanistic tradition, we arrived at the notion of love as a central healing force within the therapeutic concept. And just as this notion changed, the understanding of what was coined transference and countertransference has changed as well. You know that the original meaning of transference referred to that a client would project upon the therapist or the analyst conflicts from their own childhood, conflicts from the past. That the analyst could not be perceived correctly as a human being, but would always be misperceived. Now, within the development of psychoanalysis, this concept has changed. And it has changed to a degree that the countertransference nowadays does not mean only a reaction to those transference feelings that we get from our clients, but that the analyst, as a human being, with human weaknesses and pitfalls, with neurotic edges, and I think this is another myth that we as analysts would be free of either neurotic edges or complexes. Hopefully, however, we are more aware of what our neurotic edges are. But in our understanding nowadays, countertransference means all the feelings that I, as a person, with my personal history as an analyst and as a human being, bring into this analytic encounter. Which means there is a vulnerability as well on the part of the therapist as it is on the part of the client. Freud's original idea about countertransference was such that he felt the countertransference was an obstacle to the analytical process. He, of course, being a son of Victorian climate in Vienna, he was very much shaped by the fear and by the image of females being seductive, being destructive. And when you look at the very first case reports that we have from Freud, these were all with female clients, the so-called hysteria, the hysterical patients. And in his famous article, Notes on Transference Love, which I highly would recommend you to read when you want to deal more in depth with the issue of sexual abuse, Freud writes that these women who enter analysis would necessarily fall in love with their analysts. There would be no other way but to fall in love. And that these infatuations that these women had would sometimes be such that all they would be looking for would be to destroy the analyst, to destroy him in his function as an analyst, by luring him into a sexual relationship, by having only one thing in mind, to sexually triumph, having gained the analyst, having stripped him from his professional authority, and have him surrender to the seductiveness of the flesh. Now, this was the Freudian idea, and therefore, he said, we have to be very, very careful with our countertransference. We have careful not to fall into these traps these women lay out for us. And when you think about Jung's own involvement, Jung's own very shadowy dealing, I would say, with his issue of countertransference, I want to remind you that Jung abused his professional power as an analyst and was involved in a sexual relationship with Toni Wolff as well as with Sabina Spielrein. Now, when Freud and Jung corresponded over this, Freud wrote, well, I didn't fall into this trap as much as you did. I was pretty much endangered. I always, however, had a narrow escape. And within this context, Freud said, well, maybe this impossible profession of ours, and as you may know, psychoanalysis is often referred to as the impossible profession. So Freud said, well, maybe this impossible profession is so difficult for us because one has to be older in order to master the countertransference properly. Well, unfortunately, as we all know, age does not protect analysts from sexual exploitation. And in fact, we even know that the research that has been done trying to figure out, is there something like a profile of analysts who sexually abuse? Now, they came up with the age group which seemed mostly at risk for sexually abusing clients. And it is not the young ones, it's the age between 40 and 49. Now, various explanations have been offered to explain this. Why particularly this age? Does this have to do with the midlife crisis? Does it have to do with the narcissistic blow of aging? Or does this have to do with something that is very predominant in the health, in the profession, the issue of the burnout syndrome? It seems that after many years of working, a lot of analysts might suffer from the burnout syndrome, might feel this inner void, and try by sexually engaging in a relationship with younger, attractive females to fill this void, which, as we all know, can never be filled. And this fact shows that most of the sexual abuse that occurs is not only once. Most of the perpetrators sexually abuse more than one woman and more than once over a period of time. Those, however, who only once during their years of practicing did not manage, as it is sometimes described, to handle the countertransference properly, which is a euphemistic description of sexual exploitation, those seem to be perpetrators, analysts, who after this experience some sort of a crisis in their profession, and they are the ones that go for help. They look out for supervision or intervision in order to find out what happened within this therapeutic process that I left my professional responsibility and acted out on my sexual feelings. However, most of the perpetrators do not seek out help. The analysts in distress and those who are at risk very seldom ever talk about it. Those who have committed what is in six countries in the six states in the USA considered to be a crime, those have no insight and no feelings of guilt. This once again links the issue of sexual abuse within psychotherapy with the issue of child abuse. Because we are all familiar with the fact that those fathers or stepfathers who abuse their children lack an insight in what have done. They have done. They lack a feeling of guilt. They are very big on defense mechanisms, arguing, for example, that all they did was initiating the daughter, for example, into healthy sexuality. Now, rationalizations are very, very often used when psychotherapists are being asked to discuss why they did it. And the rationalizations usually are such that they turn the tables in terms of they are no longer the perpetrators, but they are the victims of those women who were the perpetrators. And again, I think this is a familiar dynamic in this whole area of child abuse. I think we all have to be aware that we as professionals, as therapists or analysts, that we do hold a tremendous psychological power. over our clients, and that we may use this power for healing, but with this very same power, we might do devastating damage to the soul of our clients. I think we have to understand that the analytical relationship constellates an incredible intimacy. It constellates sexual energy, and it is within our professional responsibility to deal with this. When we think about what is analysis all about, why do we go there? What does it mean? You know that the Jungians talk about analysis as a quest, an inner journey, with the ultimate goal to connect the ego with the unconscious, to establish a link to one's soul, to get into union with one's inner self. Now, starting out analysis, these images, the union and the longing for union with oneself, will be projected upon the analyst. Because at the beginning of the analytic process, we might not yet be able to establish this bond between the ego and our most deepest inner core. So what we always have been looking for, what we yearned for the very most, will be projected upon the image of the analyst. He or she becomes the person with wisdom, becomes the carrier of our self, becomes the guru figure, the mana personality. And it is because of this spiritual power inherent in the transference process that the damage that's being done to these women is so deep and so devastating. And therefore, I think it is more than just talking about the violation of a professional code. It's more than rape. It's more than ethical misconduct. It's a very deep misunderstanding of what these women really want. When analysts say, but she had wanted me, she desired the union with me in the flesh, then I think it is within our task to understand the symbolic nature of sexuality, the symbolism between this union. And we do have to sacrifice. This is within our profession. This is the sacrifice we have to do, the sacrifice to act out, the sacrifice of this union in the flesh. And instead, we need to transform this. We need the spiritualization of this unity. We often have a hard time, I think, with these sacrifices. It is within our human weakness and within our human strength to have and to be allowed to have sexual feelings. I think it is one of the pitfalls within our training at institutes and in various analytical associations that all aspects of countertransference are being discussed. We feel pretty free now in a group of training candidates to talk about our feelings of being bored sometime in an analytical hour, of getting tired, of even developing hostile feelings. But we are very hesitant to acknowledge of our feelings of being sexually aroused. And I think we do not offer very good guidance to those therapists who openly acknowledge to these feelings, to these sexual undercurrents within the countertransference. And I think we should better do so in order to guide those who guide others. I think when I spoke of Eros, I wanted to remind you of Socrates. Those of you who have been teachers, perhaps, are familiar that we talk about the pedagogical Eros. Socrates talked a lot about this, and what he meant was that the relationship which is needed for a teacher towards their students is an attitude of care, an attitude of relating to the other to improve their personal and spiritual growth. Now, if you think of the Greek meaning of the word therapy, therapeion means care. We, as analysts, we have the task to care for our clients' souls. We tend to the spirit and the soul and not to the flesh. And what we need is an attitude of empathy, an attitude of care where our whole personality comes into being. When Jung talked about transference and countertransference, he did not talk about neutrality or objectivity. He talked about the analytical relationship being a mixtum compositum of two. He talked about the union of the opposites. And he said it is like with chemical elements. When they unite, both are transformed, the client and the therapist. It's not a one-sided process. The analytical vessel, which is the image which is often used for the container of analysis, transforms both. And Eros is this creative spirit, this uniting force for transformation. And I think in a time in which we live like ours, we badly need to be reminded that we do need this creative spirit, this godly demon of Eros. And I think nowhere do we need it more than in analysis, the place of transformation. Maybe we take a little pause here. I can imagine that you might have all sorts of different questions, and I will be most willing to tailor whatever material I have towards your own needs. So touch upon a couple of points that I haven't mentioned yet. I feel it very helpful to draw an analogy. You are all familiar with what we say, what we need in order to develop healthily. We need like the gleam in the mother's eye. Now, I often find it might be helpful to understand what the women in therapy might be looking for is the gleam in the analyst's eye, which is a different gleam than the sexual acting out. And when it comes to seduction, very often, as we know, those women who act provocatively and seductively in analysis, which is in fact very often the case, are women who suffer from the inability of having a clear sense of their own boundaries. Now, it has been argued that the high-risk population for being re-traumatized in analysis by sexual victimizations are those women who already in their childhood had the experience of sexual abuse. Now, this has been discussed, sort of controversial, but from the cases that I have seen, which might have to do with the fact that I have worked with many women who were sexually abused as children, it does make sense. We all know that very often women who have been diagnosed as borderline personality are those who have difficulties with borders. And I think if you... right? And I think there, the therapist is even more called to be able to provide safe and secure boundaries so that the person can unfold their soul and show their vulnerabilities. And to use these rationalizations that, after all, they behave so provocatively is a... And the predominant sexual abuse that occurs by female clients seems to be homosexual abuse. And the psychodynamics there we have to look at very carefully because they are different. And I think the erotic transference that an adult man may have towards his female analyst, who is in a position of authority over him, which is not the usual situation a man finds itself in our culture. So what might happen in order to avoid the feelings of dependency, in order to escape this thread of the all-engulfing mother, or the threat of surrender to this female analyst, men might develop an erotic transference, fall in love with the analyst, have the analyst fall in love with them, and thereby turn the tables in the sense of now the analyst is no longer on top, but literally speaking, the client, the male client, is on top, emotional-wise and physical-wise. And we might understand this as one sort of avoiding working on these issues. And the three films that deal with this sort of male fantasy about female analysts falling in love with their male clients. There's a Hitchcock movie, Spellbound. There is Woody Allen's Selig. And another one about the man who loved women. And interestingly enough, in all these three cases, the female analysts falling in love with these male clients, they say, you lost your analyst, but you gained a lover. And following up, and of course this is movie, what happened to their profession? All these women then gave up being analysts, became housewives, and lived happily ever after. So the idea that's being put forth is that not analysis is the cure, but love. Well, these were a couple of things that I wanted to refer to. There's an interesting article by a woman analyst from Yale College who talks about specific issues of transference, male clients, female analysts. But now I open the floor to your questions and comments.
As I hear you speaking, I make a parallel in my mind to us as a society who now follow the myth of power, and by doing that ignore boundaries or blatantly take over boundaries. And I see this taking place in the therapeutic session as well as all over the world. At what point do you see the intervention taking place that changes this back so that we don't follow the myth of power and move into a myth of love or a myth of healing?
Mm-hmm.
So where does this take place? Especially you mentioned the analysts who are learning, the young analysts would be willing to announce their sexual fantasies or sexual impulses in the therapeutic session in the clinical area are not receiving help. What kind of help do they get?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of interventions do you see changing?
Mm-hmm. Two questions, at least, I hear from what you say. I tried to rephrase this, I was supposed to, for the tape. I hope I do this correctly. Well, the first is, where is the place where the myth of power that is predominant in our culture as well as in analysis changes so that it becomes healing and not destructive? And the second, which attends to this, is where would, as you phrased it, the young analysts would find help in their training when dealing with these power issues in transference, countertransference, and the sexual issues. If I start with the latter, I think, again, it is very important to be aware that not the poorly trained young analysts, those who have been out in the gray market of pop psychology or the so-called spiritual psychology, not primarily those are the ones who abuse their power, but those who are very well trained, who very often hold positions of power in their associations and in their institutes, who are training analysts just as well. And when we wonder, well, why is this? Who helps them? Then I think I would want to remind you what Freud said. Freud asked and recommended every 5 years a reanalysis. Now, I wonder, given the prices of analysis today, we could afford every 5 years a long process of analysis. But certainly, I think, it would be very helpful if we, as therapists or analysts, we evaluate where we stand, we evaluate on what values we work, and I think the best way to do this would be to have ongoing groups of supervision where a safe climate, a nurturing climate is created where we can show our own fallacies and vulnerabilities. And from a German study that has just recently been done, where therapists were asked anonymously to report if they had ever committed sexual boundary violations, those who agreed and admitted to having done so were those who had no continuous supervision, whereas those who never had committed sexual boundary violations were the group with the highest percentage with supervision. So I think this would be a very helpful tool. Now, to the first part of your question, I think it is easy to answer, maybe not so easy to apply, where, as Jung said, Eros being power, being the psychological contrary to Eros, if we let go of the power issues, if we let go of our need to dominate and manipulate others, and instead adopt an attitude where Eros might flow in, then I think we are safe, because Eros binds together. Eros is nurturing and caring, and then power is not at stake.
Maybe a whole separate topic, if you're right, but I've been interested in some reflections on clinical nerves with
this is a question about clinical work with women who were previously abused by therapists. The psychodynamics that we are faced with in follow-up treatment are very complicated. Usually we deal with people who are severely wounded in their trust of other human beings. So what we deal with is an extreme ambivalence towards therapy and therapists. We find women, or men for that matter, coming into analysis and after 2 hours maybe dropping out again, coming to another analyst, staying there for 2 hours and dropping out again. The slightest hint of feelings of eventually being misunderstood again, questioning about what had happened, is often understood as questioning of the fact as such and not about the how did it come about. It's a very sensitive issue, and I think to listen to the psyche, we needed there. We really have to listen particularly well, and we have to be very careful not to adapt an attitude to become a detective, to ask all these questions as if we wanted to interrogate, and to have very well in mind, whatever I ask, do I ask this for myself, for my own sake, for my professional interest, for my maybe gossipy interest? Maybe this person happens to be a colleague of mine whom I never liked anyway. So when I pursue these questions, is this really for me or for the client? And I often find that therapists, particularly women therapists, they get so enraged with the former therapist that they press the women to press charges against the person without acknowledging that the first thing for this other person might be something totally different. And I think it is a misunderstood sort of solidarity, or it's a not valuable feminist trait, so to speak, to press these women to do something what they are emotionally not even equipped for. Then I think we have to deal always with the feelings of immense guilt and shame. Like with incest survivors, the defense mechanism is such that the victims, they take over the guilt which originally belonged to the perpetrators. And to help clients validate their experience, understand the dynamics, this is, I think, our major goal there.
Thank you.
And I think when it comes to counseling or to accompanying the client, when the client wants to do something against the therapist, then I find it would be helpful not to leave one's therapeutic function and role and to advise the person where to seek help on a counseling level, so that not these dual overlapping functions occur. I think it touches another difficulty I find for us as professionals. How do we deal with this issue? How do you respond when you find out that the person you are sharing your office with has sexually abused a client? You see the person at the next meeting. Do you bring this up? Do you speak to this person personally? What happens if this person is in authority over you, happens to be the boss at the counseling center? And are we not guilty in joining the conspiracy of silence? Are we not perhaps eventually behaving like those mothers who so often have been scorned in child abuse cases, that they saw and did not want to see, and heard and did not want to hear? I think it's very difficult how we deal with our feelings, our emotions, counter-transference reactions. And I think it would be helpful to work this out in our peer groups, in our supervision, Yes. Unfortunately, I must say my experience is that it is very difficult to deal with this effectively, at least so far in my country. In Switzerland, the defenses to talk about this topic are incredible. I have done a lot of work now to help this become more of an issue that is being talked about on the radio within the mental health profession. We will now have the very first conference in Switzerland within a clinical setting, famous psychiatric university hospital. And when we started to raise funds for this event, those pharmaceutic firms who usually always sponsored workshops or conferences, the response was, how come you want to deal with such a dirty topic? And bad enough that you are dealing with a dirty topic, but it's even worse that you want to get money for it. So far has not been sponsored, but it will take place nevertheless. Now, my personal experience trying to talk with a colleague whom I knew on a personal level was such that he refused to talk, and with the end of the relationship, hang up the phone on me. I got an enemy, and it's very difficult. But I feel that here in the States, you are further ahead. There is, besides this, what I have been heard complaining, this punitive attitude where people would even hide more these pitfalls, there is, I find, a growing awareness. And in Australia, for example, they even have centers for distressed therapists where they can, like, call up and talk before it happens. And I think we should have that sort of help for therapists. And I think we need some sort of community services where people who have been abused in therapy, not only sexually, but emotionally or narcissistically, where they can turn to and talk and do not have to undergo an interrogation like now still in Switzerland, where the women who complained about this are made to feel that they are to blame for what has happened. And the judicial system in our country is still such that it is a re-traumatization for the woman and a stigmatization and very seldom ever a healing process for these women.
So what does it say about the nature of the therapeutic relationships in general that if there's a significant degree of this kind of abuse, what positive work might be going on in such a relationship?
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, it would seem like that would color an enormous percentage of the work.
Mm-hmm. I'm not 100% sure if I understood your question correctly. Did you ask what does this say about the condition our professional community is in?
Yeah.
I would say, well, we are in bad shape. And the other thing that I heard is, well, what can there be anything positive going on in these therapies where abuse occurs? Now, my impression is, my personal impression dealing with the cases and what I have learned from the research that I have done, that the impact and the effects are devastating and destructive. Even in those situations where women at the very beginning do not have the awareness of being traumatized, very often this comes much, much later. And I have seen major fragmentations taking place, psychotic episodes, not being able to trust one's own perception anymore. Because after all, these people who are abused in therapy, they are confronted with a complete role confusion. They are being treated, in the case of females, they are clients, and yet, as so often is the case, the analyst tends to talk more and more about himself, about the problems he has with his clients, with his profession, with his wife, and gradually the client grows into a role of being the listener, the caretaker, nurturant, the mother. On the other hand, the client becomes the offer of being the lover, the beloved. So here she is, client, mother, child, and lover. It's very confusing. Plus, on top of this, the dynamics is often such that within an hour, where the boundaries were violated, where some sort of violation takes place, not necessarily sexual intercourse on the analytic couch, which is often the case, but just some sort of sexual intimacy, the next hour, the woman might feel, as often is the case at the beginning, elated. She might feel, this is something special. This man who represents for me the embodiment of a God, a self-image, I have been so close to him. So they walk into the next hour expecting a continuation or an even more deepening of the relationship, and very often are faced with an analyst who pretends that nothing had happened the last hour, who is very rigid, who keeps all his boundaries, be it from feelings of guilt or from feelings of confusion or whatever. But these women, sometimes they do not know, well, did it take place or did it not? He behaved as if never anything else but therapy had occurred. Sometimes, however, this being distant again takes on form like a very cold, even sadistic sort of a reproachment from the side of the analyst. There is so much suffering involved for these women that I personally, I have not seen a very positive outcome out of such a relationship. Of course, it is being asked, well, how about those cases with famous examples, as we all know, in the psychoanalytic world, where the therapists decide analysis is over and the love relationship begins and marriage follows. Now, can this be? After the termination of analysis, is sex ever okay? How long do they have to wait? Do they have to wait forever, or is it okay after half a year? This is an issue which is very controversially discussed. When you think Frieda von Reichmann, the female analyst, married her client Erich Fromm. There are lots of examples of analysts, even within the Jungian community, or particularly within the Jungian community, depending on from where to look, where the analytic relationship was terminated and the love relationship and the marriage follows. Of course, we can argue that transference and counter-transference issues stretch beyond time and space. Just as a daughter does not cease to be a daughter when she leaves home, marries, becomes a mother and a grandmother, she still is the daughter of this father. One might ask, as we talk about analytical incest, should we be always there for our clients, even if they decide after 3 or 4 years to enter analysis with us? Is it ever possible to transform the asymmetrical relationship of analysis and therapy into a friendship? Very controversially discussed, and even more so in small associations where the incestuous atmosphere of institutes and training associations is just incredible. Here we lie on the couch with this analyst, and 5 years later we dance with his wife or with himself, with him, on a different occasion. How do we manage this initiation, this stepping over the border from having been the client, the student, and now being the colleague? I think this is very difficult, and again, it's not very often discussed. And I think we can see in institutes and associations that counter-transference and transference issues are not always solved, that they seem to linger on in rivalry and competition and power issues between those who once were in training. I don't know how this is going to be solved, but I think it would be helpful to heighten our awareness of these difficulties. I hope I don't sound too discouraging. Yeah. I think her name, I don't have the exact reference in mind. I think her name is Gole, G-O-L-E. And, well, if you might contact Kate Millard, I can leave the name of the article with her. Yes?
How did you do your research?
Mm-hmm. various ways. Maybe I start how I got to this topic. I have been working a lot with women who were sexually abused in their childhood. And at one of these international conferences where I spoke, a great number of women came to me afterwards and said that they had been sexually abused as children, but on top of it, they had been re-traumatized in therapy. So when I wrote my book on incest and therapy, I included a chapter on the psychotherapeutic impasse of sexual abuse in therapy. I got an overwhelming response from the German-speaking countries, and have ever since then spoken with various groups in various therapeutic schools. I have a Jungian training and I have a Gestalt therapy training. So I talked to other societies, what kind of regulations they have, and we originated all sorts of questionnaires where certain questions were being asked to a broader group of therapists, and they could answer these questions. And just recently in Germany, there was a research thesis done on behavioral therapists, because very often it was claimed that behavior therapists are particularly prone to overstep the boundaries. So a lot of questions were asked, like, for example, do you think it is okay to accept a client's invitation for lunch? How about dinner? How about using the therapeutic relationship? For example, this person happens to be a real estate agent and you just wanted to buy a house. Wouldn't that be a good deal, channeling these personal needs and exploiting thereby the therapeutic relationship? Then I think I have probably read everything that has been published on this issue. And for those of you who want to be like at the peak of the latest research data, I suggest the Walk-in Counseling Center of Minnesota, of Minneapolis. They have just brought out a book, about 900 pages, about the issue of sexual abuse. And the Minnesota Task Force, they too have brought out a book with the title It's Never Okay, which again is a collection of various articles for, towards this subject. And these are the last and I think the most broad, the broadest publications. The Minneapolis Center, I think they have so far dealt with about 1,000 cases. And of course, not only restricted to therapists within the clinical session, but they talk as well about the unholy seductions in the world of the spiritual leaders in pastoral counseling and with priests. There is a book out by Fortune, Is Nothing Sacred? And in fact, one gets the impression nothing seems to be sacred there. What else do you might want to know? Feel free to ask.
With the publication of your book,
yeah.
How have you been received by various communities?
Mm-hmm. How have I been received by various communities? I have been, as you can imagine, very well received by the female world that deals with these issues. I was strangely received, and I would like to get in contact with Peter Rutter, who in February, I think, is speaking here. And I know that he was invited to come to England, and this was very well advertised, as he said, and as a big event. The book was already out. And, of course, one would expect a great number of people coming, and 12 people showed up in London. Now, I had something similar happening. I was invited by the psychoanalytic group from a rather well-established psychoanalytics association in Freiburg. And when I arrived there, first I thought, well, maybe I'm at the wrong place. The president and the vice president and two training candidates from the university were present. And none of the other analysts showed up, very much to the embarrassment of those who extended this invitation to me. On another occasion, which again was in the psychoanalytic community, but it was open to various other groups, there were about 100 people, I would say 80 women, and although the invitation was on behalf of the Psychoanalytic Association, there were three analysts, one sex therapist who very strongly put forward the idea that sexual involvement with clients might be very therapeutic, and all the rest were women who primarily worked with other women who were sexually abused. On the other hand, I must say that wherever there are men who are engaged in this work to help within their own profession put forward this issue, there it was much easier. For example, there's a group of psychiatrists in Basel who have done some work with this, and the man who initiated this group, there I felt the ground was prepared, and I have been with this group now several times, and it was a totally different atmosphere. There was a deep concern with the men who worked there about the misbehavior and misconduct of their colleagues. So I feel it's difficult to generalize. But all in all, I would say hopeful and a positive response.
Given how difficult it must be to gather the statistics because people would be so unwilling to tell the truth, what is your sense of how widespread it is?
Mm-hmm. You asked about the statistics and, of course, about the difficulty to get exact data, because the dark figure is so high. Usually I say, after all, statistics don't say a thing. And I have learned in my statistics class, never trust a statistic that you have not falsified yourself. And after all, I think, specifically within our area,
and that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.